Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 106.
Etunda Sixingelska. That's Swedish.
Well, we had quite a morning. First time back in the Beyond Babel Theater for a year.
Yeah, we went and saw the theater, made sure everything looked good. And I have to tell you, the last time we went was April 24th, 2020, because we needed to go get some merchandise because people were still buying it online. And it was one of the most depressing days ever. Times Square was completely
dead.
All of the marquees for all the Broadway theaters were covered up. I mean, it was just so sad. And the theater was sad because it was like, we have no idea when we're coming back. And we both felt horrible after. But today I felt really like reinvigorated and excited.
I'm excited now. I mean, we were at Washington Square Park. It was full of people not wearing their masks and like looking like it was normal. And when we were at the church, they were doing a lot of construction on the outside of it. So there was all this
scaffolding back in 2020,
and now it's all off and the building looks beautiful and you can see all the Beyond Babel posters still up, and we go in the theater and everything looks great. You know, I'd like worried maybe mice or
mold
or water damage, I don't know, something would happen to the set or the lights or the costumes or any of it, and everything was fine. I mean, looking at the crochet in particular was just so bright and beautiful. I'm so excited to see the show again, and we're going to reopen it. We announced it before, but for those who didn't catch it, it's going to begin performances again September 28th.
Yeah, it was crazy opening the dressing rooms because, Josh and I went back, but we didn't open the dressing rooms. And the dressing rooms were exactly as the cast left it on March 13th, 2020. So it's definitely like a little time capsule. And we're going to need to do some cleaning in there.
Did you find anything back there?
No, just, some mice droppings. But hey, that's New York for you, right?
Yeah, it's a New York City theater in a basement. So aside from our show reopening, everybody seems to be announcing awesome new projects. One of which that was announced yesterday is a new Seven Finger show in San Francisco from Gypsy and Shayna, two past podcast guests.
Yes, it is so exciting. I mean, Josh and I have heard a little bit about this project prior to the press release. So I just want to make sure I don't say anything that's not in the press release, because as things come out, I think everyone's going to get more and more excited. It's such a cool project. But basically, Shayna Carroll and Gypsy Snyder, two of the Seven Fingers Collective from Montreal, their home base, their homegrown city is San Francisco. And I know from talking with both of them on our podcast, their goal was always to come back and do something in San Francisco. And they're taking over the space called Club Club Fugazi. But this show, Beach Blanket Babylon, ran there for 45 years, and then due to the pandemic, kind of the lady who was running it was done with it. Gypsy found it, was able to take it over, and now they're creating a show for this space, and it's a love letter to San Francisco, and I think it's going to be super cool.
I mean, this is no diss to Montreal, but it is an example of what we talked about before of like most of the new circus happening in Montreal probably won't be the case post pandemic. And it's interesting to see, you know, arts go into cities that are otherwise reputationally damaged. I think most people think of San Francisco right now as a place that people are leaving to go to like Texas or go to Florida, kind of like New York. But that's also when the arts are the most important. So it'll be an interesting opportunity. There are also like loads of tech people out there who can probably pay for some nice expensive tickets, so we'll definitely take a trip out there and check it out.
Yeah, there's an article in the New York Times and it kind of talks about it a little bit more, but I think what's interesting is people were like, why don't you come back to America and do arts here? And it's like, well, here they are, you know, they're coming back and providing a lot of solid jobs to circus artists in America, in California, in San Francisco, where their circus journey started. Because, you know, for those who don't remember or don't know, Shayna started her circus career also with the Pickle Family Circus as, you know, training trapeze, I think it was. And that's how she met Gypsy. And then that whole journey started. I mean, I said this before, but it is crazy how many people have touched Pickle Family Circus or Gypsy Snyder, been, you know, influenced by or actually met. And that's how their circus journey started. So it's awesome that it's coming back. And we will definitely be taking a trip out to San Francisco.
San Fran.
Have you been there recently?
No, I think the only time. No, I don't even. I don't know if I've ever been to San Francisco. Now
really?
That I'm saying that out loud.
Oh my God.
I know. That makes it maybe a little bit more exciting.
My grandmother lived there for a bit, and then I went out for a bit in college by myself, and it was really fun. So, good Mexican food.
Oh, good to know. Probably not as good as in LA or San Diego.
Yeah, that's true. Although I still think New York has the best Mexican food, and every Californian wants to kill me.
Bringing it back to home to New York City, some interesting developments with how Broadway's reopening, what's going to happen. There's just constant drama, of course, because that's like Broadway and nobody can agree on anything thanks to having 16 different unions. And then things that aren't unions that are like guilds and producers organizations. It just seems like nobody can act as a group. And just to shake that all up even more, now the New York State Assembly, so that's just the like sort of Congress for New York State, have a bill floating through it to totally shake up the way ticketing works in New York State.
Producers of these shows must be shaken in their boots. Basically, here's a very quick
summary.
Summary of ticketing in Broadway, on Broadway. Essentially, it's dynamic pricing, like an airline. When you go buy a ticket, maybe you look back the next day and it's super high because the buying pattern, they've noticed that people are searching this certain flight. So the dynamic pricing goes up and down depending on demand.
Yes,
supply demand.
On Monday, the ticket costs $85 and on Friday, it costs $130. And they bring it up only because they know more people buy tickets on Friday than on any other day.
So the theater adopted this style of ticket pricing from the airlines and they applied it to ticket pricing in the theater. This really stinks because you could buy a $75 ticket in the orchestra and then the next day your friend buys a $350 ticket to the seat next to you. And it was always kind
controversial.
Maybe controversial, but also something that you know you did. And honestly, coming from a standpoint of producing.
You know you did it if you were like seeing Broadway shows all the time. If you're just somebody who comes in and sees a Broadway show, I don't think you necessarily understand at all how that game is working.
That's true. And I think I've been at a show once where someone said, I've heard people talking, how much did you pay for this ticket? And someone says, you know, $100. And the guy next to him's like, what the heck? I paid like $250. And, you know,
next to them goes, what the heck? I got this on Gold Star.
Right.
For $25.
I got this for $25. Right. So it's really, it actually is pretty terrible for the ticket buyer. But for the producer, like you're getting as much money as you possibly can. So they're trying to cap this.
Plus, so that's sort of like on the individual producer side, how do you price your tickets? On the venue side of it, they're saying that venues can no longer force you to use their ticketing software. So in the case of the Schuberts, that's Telecharge. In the case of Nederlanders, that's Ticketmaster. In the case of Jujamsen, that's SeatGeek. So if you want to do a show in any of those theaters, you have to agree to use Ticketmaster and pay all the fees and do all the things Ticketmaster has. And then Ticketmaster only gives that data to themselves in the theater. The show doesn't get to keep any of the data.
Right. So it's pretty detrimental to the show because Ticketmaster or Telecharge or SeatGeek, the theater owner keeps all the data, charges a fee, charges a service fee, charges a facility fee, and gets a lot of money from the ticketing platform. Oh, as well as rent from the show and a percentage of the gross. So they're really making bank. And I think this is great because also like the Telecharge software isn't
terrible.
That great. And it forces them to actually be competitive on the service fee, be competitive on the software, and be competitive on the interface with the audience. And also, hopefully, you get the audience list. So this is actually a really interesting topic. But it also seems like with the seat pricing, if you release a block of seats as a producer at maybe you say $79, you then can never release another ticket in that block of seats at a higher price. So that's a little challenging. I think it is actually like going to be a problem because if you're like, oh, well, I could have actually charged more. Okay. But now I think people are going to be like, okay, well, if I can't charge more, I can only go down. Might as well start high.
The whole thing to me that is like the most confusing part of if this will pass or if this won't pass and will it happen or won't it happen is like, who gives a shit? I'm like, why is this congressman passing this bill now? There's so many important things happening in New York with restarting New York, with helping New York, helping the country. So many so many things happening and we give a shit about ticket pricing on Broadway.
And ticketing software.
It's just strange. And then who would vote for it and who would vote for against it? Or who would vote against it? It's just New York State, strange politics, strange things. But that's why Broadway is what Broadway is. And New York State is the power player of live entertainment, other than maybe Nevada.
Speaking of ticketing, one thing Josh and I are trying to do for our show that we are doing this summer, which will be
soon announced.
Soon announced, is trying to make tickets affordable for families, since we know everyone has been hit hard this year. And I'm really, really hoping and excited by the prospect of bringing people together. Just walking around New York City today and being in the theater reminded me how important it is for interpersonal connections, being around people, connecting, watching a piece of art, and having that shared experience. I feel like this past year, we've definitely lost that and been isolated. And it's easy to forget how much joy that brings to you as a human being. And I definitely did. I mean, obviously, intellectually, I didn't. But today, just being there, I just was like, wow, this is going to be such a wonderful moment to be back. So this summer, I just can't wait. I can't wait to see people. I can't wait to see people watching a show and being together again.
But while we are still not attending shows, one of the things you can do, aside from listening to our podcast, is listen to our guests' podcast. Today, we have Shannon McKenna. You guys will probably know her from The Artist Athlete. I think other than us, she's the most regular circus podcast out there. There are a few others, but she's been going for a while, has over 100 episodes. It's interesting, her sort of perspective on the circus industry. We have a lot of things in common. We both went to NYU Tisch, based in New York, so very exposed to the Broadway world. She later moves to Montreal and does circus, but also has spoken to loads and loads of people in the circus community for the podcast and seen a lot of different takes. She tends to interview more circus artists while we tend to interview more circus producers, but not exclusively really on either side. And I've spent many hours enjoying episodes of hers with guests that we haven't booked, but at least I don't have to interview them. I get to listen to them. So I was really excited to talk to Shannon and get a sense of her podcasting experience or circus experience and just get to know her a little bit better. And for those of you who listen to both our podcasts, you'll have the fun of hearing us talk to one another.
We did record this before. And we kind of got off the rails and just had such an interesting conversation for about 2.5 hours, just about circus. And it was really interesting, but it was like all over the place. Our baby was crying
for a good hour and a half.
And, you know, we were like, you know, we should probably redo this for our listeners and her listeners. So we ended up doing it more old school style, where we interviewed her for our podcast. She interviewed us for her podcast. And I think both interviews were much more easy to listen to and interesting than our rambling on about circus. Although, I don't know, some people maybe would have enjoyed our rambling.
But before we let you listen to the episode,
if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. We love guest requests and suggestions, so please keep them coming.
And don't forget to get your tickets to Beyond Babel, reopening September 28th in New York City. Tickets are at beyondbabelshow.com. Come see the show indoors, experience that connection Lindsay's talked about, and come meet us in person.
And without further ado, here is Shannon.
Shannon, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. I'm so excited to talk with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
Thank you guys for having me. I'm super excited. Wait, can I say again? Or should we not talk about the fact that we did this before?
No, we can out that we tried this before.
Okay. Yes. So thank you for having me again. We don't have to say anything more about that. I'm coming from Montreal. I'll answer y'all's questions.
Awesome. Well, I feel like though we should just say we did try to do this before, but then we got too into the weeds of circus, which was actually really interesting, but maybe not easy to follow as a podcast listener. Plus, so now we're trying again.
Plus baby crying for 60% of it in the room.
Cyrus, yeah.
So I have a feeling this will be we'll do a take two, but I have some good things I know we can talk about on this episode.
So we've talked a lot about this stuff, but I want to ask it again in a way that listeners can, you know, easily absorb.
Absorb.
So you're in
totally.
So you're in Montreal, but we know you're not from Montreal. So where are you from originally?
No, I am a native Atlantan. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia originally. It's where I grew up. And then I went to school at NYU, so New York University, which is in New York City. And then I spent 3 years at the New England Center for Circus Arts, which is in Vermont. Then I helped a dude open a flying trapeze rig in Texas. So I was in Texas for a hot minute. And then I lived on the West Coast. I was in San Francisco for like a year, but actually like going back and forth from like Mexico to San Francisco. And then I was like back and forth between like Europe and the state, you know, like, and then I like circus does this to you. But in 2019, I moved to Montreal in September and am like, I am a visitor, but I am, I can't legally say I'm seeking residency. So I'm hanging out here.
Nice. So where do you call home though? Like you listed a whole bunch of places. If I was like, where's back home? Is that.
So I file my taxes in Georgia and I pay rent in Montreal.
Nice. So in high school, yeah. Were you doing the performing arts? Were you doing circus? Mm-hmm.
Your exposure? I went to a performing arts high school. I was like, I was a theater nerd kid, like from when I was like a little kid. Like I was the Alliance Theater is the Equity Theater in the South. They actually won, I want to say it was like a Tony or something for like regional theater a while ago. But I, when I was like in first grade, I did a drama program after school because a friend of mine was in it and you always do everything your friend does. But the woman who ran the program was like, you know, your daughter's like, she knows how to deliver a line. Like you, she's got something, you should foster this talent. My mom was like, sure. So I've been doing scene study and like theater, performing arts, dance, all that kind of stuff since I was like a really little kid.
Did you see any circuses come through town though as a kid? Anything that was like, oh, that's amazing?
I watched Cirque du Soleil. I remember seeing, I want to say it was Salt and Bonco, maybe, the contortion act. And I was like, I could probably do that, you know, but I always was a physical theater kid. Like the school I went to was really informed by a lot of like the City Company and Bogart, that kind of work. So I was doing a lot of like viewpoints where, and I went to NYU to study with Mary Overly, who's like the creator of viewpoints. So it was always a lot of physical stuff, but circus didn't come into my life until I went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and I saw the No Fit State. And it's like one of the things that they advise you to do when you're a theater person, I think any artist, it's great advice, is go out and see a lot of whatever you want to make, you know, so you can learn your taste. You can learn what you like, you can learn what you don't like. And so I went to the Edinburgh Fringe and just saw a bunch of stuff. And I saw the No Fit State. And I forgot what show it was. I want to say Bianco, but I don't think that's right. But it was like in the tent. And instead of having people sit, you were kind of like in this crowd and they would just push you out to one side and an act would just like drop down and happen. And then you kind of like,
I think that is Bianco. I think that's,
is that Bianco?
I think that's the one we saw.
That was the one that went to Brooklyn for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. But that's how it was.
That was like also the peak of immersive too. Like when people were like, how do you do shows?
Oh, yeah,
you know? And also for those who are listening, No Fit State is a Welsh company, right? That's, mm-hmm. that's the origin.
Yes.
One thing, going back to my leading some questions about NYU, I know you're also a Tishy, like NYU Tisch School, like I am, but you're in the acting program, and the acting program, for those who don't know, is like split up into different wings. So maybe you could talk a little bit about ETW, because that does, in a weird way, like relate a lot to physical theater and this world.
Yeah. So the way it works at NYU is you audition for the school, and you audition to get into the acting program. But within the program, there's a lot of different like subs. They're called studios. I think there's like seven. I don't know how many of them there are now. It's kind of like the Sorting Hat in Harry Potter. I know Harry Potter's problematic now, so we can't really reference him anymore. But that's the best analogy I can use, is you don't really know why, but there's some powers that be that like decide that you're going to go to a different studio. And I was actually a Meisner-trained actor my first 2 years. I wanted to go to ETW, which is the experimental theater wing, which is physical theater and a lot of like self-scripting, making your own work. But I got into Meisner and it was basically like, you can't change when you get in. You don't have the option. I think you probably could, like you could really fight them. But like I was like 18 and didn't know. I was just happy to be accepted. So I did 2 years of like classical Meisner, which is, oh man, how deep do we want to get into
this? Go for it.
I studied Meisner as well. So
oh, you studied Meisner as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. That's the
I got the joke. If you don't know Meisner, maybe explain it a little bit.
So the best way that I categorize the NYU studios is like light bulb jokes. So like the Meisner joke is like, how many Meisner students does it take to change a light bulb? How many Meisner students does it take to change a light bulb? And it's basically because in Meisner trained actors, we do less script analysis and the interest is more on the actions that are caused by doing a task. So in like the Meisner approach, you pick a, this is really distilled, but you pick a really difficult thing to do. And then you have an acting partner
who comes to your door.
He comes to your door and you open the door and you're trying to sew jewelry into a bra to sell it on the black market.
I did that one.
No, yeah, because
not on the black market, but I was hot gluing because I couldn't sew.
Mm. Yeah. So basically you have to do a really difficult task and you have to make up a reason why you have to do that task in a certain amount of time. And it's like life or death. So you're like crying because your father's been taken by terrorists and you need the ransom money and blah, blah, blah. And this person comes to your door and just starts talking to you. And you just repeat whatever. So it's not about the words, but you're saying like, I'm sad. You're sad. I'm sad. You're sad. And so from that, you kind of figure out like what kind of pinches you emotionally. You figure out a lot of stuff, actually.
I think it sounds silly, but it was, for me, coming not from Meisner. I was taught not Meisner. I don't even really know what they would say. But it was, like, freeing in a way because you're so focused on doing something so not real. Like, it's, like, disassociating almost with, like, the task that you're doing. That was, like, less about the words and, like, acting on the words and more just about, like, acting through the emotions. And I felt like that was actually a really wonderful acting challenge for me, at least. But, you know, it sounds silly, but I think it actually does work in some ways for people.
Yeah, I think it has its strengths and weaknesses, just like any acting methodology. Yeah. But it is one of the, like Meisner is, so the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is when Stanislavski, who's like this Russian dude who like invented acting as we know it, like the way we think about acting is like an internal to external thing. He came and he taught a group of people and, Sanford Meisner and what's his name? Lee Strasberg, who was like the one who like taught Marilyn Monroe and, you know, all these people. He was kind of in that category. And so there was like, so Stella Adler has a studio. Lee Strasberg has a studio. Sanford Meisner. These are all the NYU studios that
Atlantic.
Are kind of like of that Atlantic, which is David Mamet. So that's very much like his whole thing is like Meisner, but it's actually about the playwright. The thing about the Atlantic kids, you always knew when someone studied at Atlantic because they were very good speakers. They were very articulate. They knew that it was about the words and they like hit their consonants. I'm speaking like someone from Atlantic right now. You know, like they really knew what was up. So ETW was based kind of on Jerzy Grotowski, who's this Polish guy who wrote this book called Towards the Poor Theater. And instead of going from the inside out, like Meisner or Strasberg or any of these kinds of people who would like imagine your dead mother and then cry about that and that's your character in Streetcar Named Desire, Jerzy Grotowski was like, okay, well, what are you doing and how does that make you feel? So it was much more about like movement-based practices and creating character that way. And from that, you kind of figured out a way to, I don't know. But ETW, what was great about it, because so what I did was I did my 2 years in Meisner. I served my time. You do 2 years in your first studio. And then if there's a third year, you can continue on. There's not with Meisner. It's only a 2-year program. So you have to audition again to get into a higher studio. And it's kind of some of them, you kind of like they have some because you have to complete the credits and NYU wants you to graduate. So sometimes you can like get through with like other places, but there are some really competitive ones and ETW is very competitive. So I was really lucky to get into it. And that was like, classes in like postmodern dance, self-scripting was a really fun class.
Were you there when the clown Spencer Novick was there?
Yes. So have you had him on the show?
He's actually just like you. We did an episode that has never been posted. So
remember half of it is like, blah, 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 like garbled. So we have to redo our episode with
but we have one saved on a computer somewhere that, you know.
Well, Spencer Novick and I were scene partners in A Merchant of Venice.
Oh,
Shakespeare. Yeah, we did a scene. What was it? The quality of mercy is not strained or whatever.
Well, we had him read a Shakespeare sonnet for our wedding.
So, oh, really?
And he was so nervous. So now I'm going to say, I heard you study Shakespeare in school.
Yeah, he did. I was there. I was his partner.
So when you go and see No Fit for the first time and that expands your mind, what is it about that you weren't getting from this like immersion into theater in New York?
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually just wrote this. I was being interviewed by some like Indian blog publication today and I had to write a bunch of questions. And I wrote what I write. I wanted to do with my body what Shakespeare did with words. I love Shakespeare. I think it's amazing. But something I really love is this idea that like people love sports so much because in sport, it's like the only form of entertainment where you don't know the ending beforehand. You know, like in Shakespeare, you go and watch Hamlet, like we all, spoiler alert guys, Hamlet's gonna die. You know, like we all know the ending. And that's why it's so thrilling and so much fun when like something comes out where you're like, how is this gonna end? Because most TV, most entertainment is pretty predictable. So when you kind of take away the element of like surprise or that kind of daring, it's like, where is the danger? Where is the risk? Where is the immediacy? And yes, that can come from an emotionally vulnerable place on stage, but I saw No Fit State and I saw these people hanging, you know, 30, 40 feet in the air. And I didn't know if they were going to do the trick. I didn't know if they were going to succeed. And the actual like risk was very apparent to me. And I was like, wow, that's thrilling theater. I didn't know it was circus at the time. I didn't know what it was, but I was like, whatever that is, I'm going to do that. Cause that's awesome.
So you see it, then what's the next step after I want to do that?
The next step was to go home and tell my mom that I was quitting university and I was going to become a circus artist, to which she was like, absolutely not. That's insane.
Wait, I didn't realize, did you leave NYU? You didn't graduate?
No, I graduated. Oh. I graduated. Yeah. Basically because my parents thought college was really important. I think if I had been a little braver, I wouldn't have, but they were paying for it, you know, and I feel really fortunate to have like graduated from NYU debt-free, which is not something I can say for a lot of people. So, you know, I did the thing. But the whole time I was doing it, I was like, I knew that there was a physical theater company called Double Edge Theater, and they're out in Western Massachusetts. They're actually quite near the New England Center for Circus Arts. And they were the only place I knew because they had come and done a show at a small theater in Atlanta. And I'd seen their work and they had an aerial silk in it. So I knew that they kind of did physical theater or something. I didn't know what NECA was yet. And so I went, I worked at a cafe in New York on the weekends and I saved up enough money so that over the winter break, I went and I did like a winter intensive there. And I met a girl named Dora Schaefer, who is a contortionist.
Oh, I know Dora.
You know Dora?
We went to camp together. I think I've probably known her since we were like 10, 11, maybe at Smirkus camp.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know she was a Smirko. Huh.
Maybe, I don't think she did tour, but she definitely did camp with me.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay. So I met her there and this was my second year at NYU. She was in her first year at ETW, just about to do the thing, drop out and move to the West Coast. But I met her and I was like, wait, you do this circus thing? I want to do that. Where do you go? And she was like, well, I have a contortion teacher in New York and there's this place in Vermont that also does circus. And I was like, oh, okay. Good to know. So I just kind of like laid low, did my time at NYU. And then when I graduated, I had a physical theater company actually called Fish and Bicycle. And we did site-specific theater.
A circus company.
I know. It's such a good name, right? Fish and Bicycle Productions. I don't know if I don't know.
Yeah, the artist athlete, just throw that out. Use fish and bicycle.
Yeah, screw that. Yeah. Fish and bicycle. It was a great name. But we did, what did we do? So we were in Provincetown in the summer and we did like a piece on a beach years before we, because we were all from the same high school and we would come together in the summers and do basically make weird art in people's backyards. Or like we did one on like the Emory University parking garage, where it was like you take the audience and you go up the stairs and you're telling them a story the whole time. So it was that kind of weird stuff. So I did that for a summer and then that fell apart because we were all like, you know, half of us were just like stoners who wanted to party. I had just come from this really intense, like I just come from NYU, which is like a lot of ideas and pretty disciplined training. So we were all just kind of not in the right place. We disbanded, unfortunately. Fish and Bicycle, who knows who owns the name now? I do after this interview. I'm going to take that and just run with it. And so after that, I moved back to Georgia. I moved to Athens, and there's a place there called Canopy Studios, which is an aerial dance studio, which is started by a woman named Susan Murphy. And to be honest, I know Susan quite well now, but I don't actually know how she's connected to Elsie and Serenity, who were the founders of the New England Center for Circus Arts. They're connected somehow, but I don't quite know how they're connected. But I guess she taught them. She's from the aerial dance. And I'm talking like, maybe this is too deep and circusy, but like there was a time where they had like aerial dance trapezes, which are these very thick wooden dowel bars. It's almost like a couch of a trapeze. The ropes are really thick and they're low flying. So they're like maybe, I don't know, like a foot off the ground. You know, they don't, it's kind of that kind of work, which is how Canopy started. But then as aerial silks, as all of that kind of rose in popularity, they started teaching more of that. So I went down there for a year. I somehow created an audition video good enough to get to NECA. And then I went to NECA.
How is it going from New York City to rural Brattleboro, Vermont? Like for a year or two? How long was the program?
It was 2 years. I stayed there for three. But the last year I feel like I was in and out of New York City and Montreal a lot more. I kind of got out of town more. Dude, it was really hard to go from New York to Athens, Georgia, because not only was it a small town, it was the South in a small town, which I had worked very hard to get out of. So, I don't know. NECA, I don't know. I don't want to shade NECA on this program, but it's a very different type of program than my theater training at NYU, especially at ETW. They were both very physical, but as a necessity in circus, there's a lot of technical training that's required, and NECA's attention to especially fundamental technique is probably what they're best known for. So for me, it was difficult. It was really difficult to have to kind of like throw away a lot of my creative aspirations and hunker down. I'm a better artist for it now, but I hated it at the time.
Was there ever a part of you though that wanted to stay in New York and audition and do the actor thing? Or was that just never something you desired to do?
I remember you're required to take a class in your fourth year there. It's called Preparing for the Profession. And I remember this agent came in to talk to us. And I remember asking him, I remember being like, what if I just want to like go travel around Asia for a little while and then come back? Like, is it too late if I like come back at 28? And he was like, yes, that's too late. You'll never work if you start in this industry at 28. Go for a year, 23. You still look a bit young. You'll be okay. And I was like, this is garbage. But I was already out the door. You know, like I always knew that I wanted to do something that was more on the physical side. Like I'd never set out to do Broadway. I love that kind of work. Actually, like now I think it's way cooler, but I'd never set out to do that kind of work. So I always knew that New York probably wasn't, though I love it there, wasn't the place for me forever.
So what did you pursue discipline wise at NECA? And once you'd graduated, did you feel like you were ready, or did you feel like there was still some kind of part to complete that circus training?
I trained rope and contortion, and you know, the sad thing is my contortion act actually was a lot better than I gave it credit for, but I thought I needed things that I now know I didn't need in it. I didn't have a very strong handstand, you know, for instance, which is like a requisite, I think, of a lot of like traditional contortion. But at the time I was watching a lot of stuff that was coming out of the National Circus School, which is a big circus school in Montreal. And I was into a lot of like movie acro-y dance kind of contortion. But I remember a person from the school, one of the teachers, at like the final, they have a picnic for us every year. And she turned to me and she was like, you know, your final act, it was really beautiful. It's a shame we can't sell it because it's not what people are looking for. And I was like, I kind of wish you had told me that, you know, while I was making it instead of while I like went through this whole process and then put it on stage. So I thought it wasn't marketable, but then I went to Texas and I actually performed it at the Floating Cabaret in New York, the Galapagos.
When it still existed.
When it's RIP. And, you know, it got a great reception. People were booking it. I remember this, an agent reached out to me from Germany and wanted to see it. And I didn't even send the video because I was like, this isn't good enough. They're not going to take it. So I actually think I came out of there a lot better than I gave myself credit for, unfortunately.
I feel like
which I think sometimes happens to artists.
Yeah, and also the idea that, I don't know where the idea comes from, but the idea that an act is different as being like, oh, well, I don't know who's going to book that. Because when we're like trying to look for acts and for people, the more different the act, the better it is for a show. Because everyone's seen, you know, all the same kind of looking contortion. But when there's something different, you're like, oh, this is interesting and fun and different. I think where it becomes a problem is if you don't have like a full act, but you have a lot of skills. And then that person is like, well, I can't make you an act. Like that's almost worse than having like an act that looks different. So
no, I agree. But I think for them, I think that there's a very, and I think New England Smirkus, I think of this too. And I'm not trying to say this is a read because I think it's actually a really lovely thing. Is it kind of feels like the last kind of breaths of what a certain type of circus was. That's not quite the super classical, you know, like family Florida style traveling circus, but drew from that and knows that that works for families and on a certain level and hasn't really gotten the weird, like, let's dress in all black and feel our feelings kind of circus, you know, let's do an act ecstatic. It's kind of living between those two worlds and doesn't quite know what it's.
And it's very literally between Montreal and New York as well.
Like, you know? That's it.
Well, in Florida.
That's it.
Like Florida.
A little closer to Montreal than Florida, but I feel like emotionally maybe a little bit closer to.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know.
One of the things on this topic that I think is interesting, and you I'm sure have witnessed this. I feel like in New York City, the audiences have a greater expectation for theatricality. And in like Montreal or a place that has more high quality circus, theatricality is less important and they want to see like crazy technique or something they haven't seen before. And I think that's because New York's a real theater city. So people like theater and that's what they're kind of looking for when they go out. And in more circusy cities like Montreal, they're more educated about the circus offerings. Agree? Disagree?
I think that if you are entertaining, you will make it anywhere. I don't know if I necessarily agree that Montreal doesn't appreciate theatrics. I just don't think they have the toolkit for it as much because we work so much on technique here. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think that a really high level act from Montreal would be received well in New York City.
That's sure.
You know, like I don't know if that's. If
I guess
necessarily...
when we're talking about like the Floating Cabaret, I like go back and think of like those acts weren't about the craziest technique. Many of the best ones were like the ones that had the best sort of theatrical premise, you know, behind it. Of course, there's people who have great technique, but there's always something a little bit different. I think that's kind of what makes the New York circus scene
a little bit different from other places. Especially in Australia and Canada and Europe, but maybe not so much. It's like the appreciation for a higher skill level, the bar is higher already because they've seen more circus versus New York. People don't really see it that much, so the level of skill can be lower if the art is still as appealing, if that makes sense. You know, I don't think people are like, oh, well, where's the seven ball trick? in New York. And maybe in Montreal, they'd be like, oh, well, he couldn't. He juggled five really well, but we never saw more. And know that as like a conscious thing that they've seen more of.
I don't know. I definitely, well, there's a larger circus population here, right? So, but as far as like the run of the mill audience here, you know, it's interesting, actually. I was in a meditation group with a woman who found out I was a circus artist, and she was talking to me about Cirque du Soleil. And she was like, I used to love to see their shows because they were really telling stories. And now I don't like to see them as much. And the technical level in Cirque du Soleil has not gone down. No. Well, we could argue that, but whatever. But there is some kind of standard. So I think that even here, the audience, like the normal people who, you know, like have office jobs and all of that, I think that they're, actually probably as discerning as any other audience anywhere. I would say, like, if you can sell a good five ball act, people will watch it for sure. I think that it's true anywhere that like, it's not enough to have the tricks unless the tricks are crazy. And even then you have to be able to like show that the tricks are crazy. You can't be like smoking a cigarette, throwing it down and then doing it, you know?
Although that would be actually, a great act. I would pay to watch that too. Like someone is dragging a cigarette, putting it out and then throwing it.
So now going back to sort of like your bio, yeah. Now you spent all this time in school. How does that transition go from being a student essentially to a professional?
So what did I do? Okay. So my first year, I was really scared to leave NECA too. I think a lot of people in my year anyway, it was a little bit of an older year, which means a lot of people graduated and they had, you know, like they already had studios or they already had, you know, there were people from Chicago. So there's already like a scene in Chicago. There were people coming from Texas, coming from other places. Whereas I was like, I want to be a circus artist. I don't know what that means. I'm just going to the school. Tell me how to do it, you know? And so I didn't really have anywhere to go back to. So I spent a year, like I said, in a residency program, which is basically me just continuing to train, sharpening my skills. I was in a troupe called Girls on Trapeze. We did like a Southeastern tour. I did an off-Broadway show as a contortionist. It was a Greek Andromache, I think was the name of the show. And I was like the god at the end. You know how like in all Greek shows, there's like some bullshit goes down. And then at the end, they're like, don't worry, a god will save you. I was the deus ex machina in the show. So I did a bunch of like random things like that at Galapagos that year. I did some work. So I was kind of like still in the nest egg of NECA, where I was like, I had a place to train every day. I had like, I was living in small town Vermont. So it wasn't like I was booking corpos every weekend.
Did Girls on Trapeze do a thing at Skirball?
I don't know.
It was like,
oh yes, they did, but I wasn't in it. Okay,
because there was one woman who was like very pregnant in the act.
Oh yeah, yes, Jamie, I think.
Okay,
is it Jamie? Do you know Jamie Hodgson?
No, I don't know.
Oh, I met Jamie. She's also a NECA person, right?
Yeah, she's a NECA person, and she probably would have been the one who was very pregnant.
Always very badass to see pregnant ladies crushing dance or circus or acting on stage. It's always another whole other level.
Yeah, it's cool. Why not? You know. Anyway, so what was the So I did a bunch of that stuff, and then I left. I got a job helping a dude open a flying trapeze rig in Dallas, Texas, actually. So it wasn't even performing that took me down there. But that's how I got in with Lone Star Circus, which is run by Fanny Kerwich of the Kerwiches. This is a French circus family. Dominique Jandot, who is Circopedia is the name of the website. Yeah, he was a clown and a circus historian. He's married to Elena Panova, who's an incredible swinging trapeze artist. He's like on the board. So I didn't know that I was like moving to this place that this really cool company was located. I was just moving there to help a dude open a flying trapeze rig, basically. But I went in one. So I went to all the circus schools in the area and I was like, hey, I just graduated from this school. This was like 2013. So it was right before the kind of aerial craze circus, I feel like, had a moment of like being the it exercise thing. It was right before that. So everyone was looking for like good teachers who knew their stuff. And I was one of them. And they found out that I was also doing because NECA graduates you with a lot of aerial work. They're aerialists. I could teach it. But they found out I was a contortionist as well. And so they started booking me for a ton of corpos. So I did a lot of gala work in corporate work, gala work, kind of interchangeably. I did a lot of that in Texas. So I would go and I would, you know, do weekends where I'd do like Dos Equis or Four Seasons or, you know, like all that kind of stuff.
Doing contortions.
Mostly doing, I mean, ground acts are what kind of sell. It's very, like, even back then, it was just so much easier to get booked as a contortionist, which is, I think, always true in the industry. If you're, like, one of the greatest pieces of advice, which I didn't follow, I never kept up my contortion skills, but if you're interested in the industry, you should probably, in your aerialist, you should have a ground act. You should be able to do something impressive on the ground.
Yes, I agree. Ideally, you always have two things you can do.
That's it.
Ideally.
And they're different enough. Like two aerial apparatuses. Come on, guys. No. Yeah.
So now you're in Texas.
I'm in Texas.
Are you ever like, I've got to get out of Texas? I mean, the thing about Texas to me is that it has like, it's one of these places with an amazing circus culture, like San Francisco or Florida or Vermont. Like they all have
You think Texas is an amazing circus
historically
culture?
It does. Maybe right now say there's only one thing, but there's been the history of circus in Texas goes back to the beginning of Texas. Mm-hmm. And there's many famous female circus Texas owners. If you like look at circus, like that's kind of a neat thing about Texan circus history in particular, Fanny continuing that tradition. So when does the idea of doing a podcast enter your realm?
Oh, we've got to skip a lot of years for that.
Don't skip them, just do a fast forward.
I'm in Texas. We're in Texas for a while, and my boyfriend at the time was a straps artist, and he found out about this coach, Juan Luis. Juan Luis Gonzalez was the first person to do a full twist on one arm. A full twist on one arm is where you go from meat hook, you go to flag, and then you do a second twist, so you're back in like a folded position again. It's not really that important that you guys fully understand all of that, but he was the first person to do a trick that now is kind of common in every straps repertoire, but at the time, like, no one was doing. So he wanted to go down and train with him. I was like, sure. So we went down to Guadalajara for a while and trained. And San Francisco had always been like to my mind, and I think this is just objectively true in the U.S., like a circus hub and a place that like I felt like I couldn't call myself an American circus artist or a U.S. circus artist until I had like gone through the San Francisco Circus Center at some point and did something there. So I moved to the Vulcan, which is a warehouse in Oakland, California, right outside of San Francisco. It's in the Bay, and it's where a lot of jugglers, a lot of people come through. And I lived there for a little while, and I trained and I taught at the San Francisco Circus Center. I gigged a little bit in San Francisco. My boyfriend at the time and I had a duo straps act, and we had booked it for a show at Kinetic Arts. And then he went off to Germany to do the show Soap, and I went to teach at Smirkus, and we like did this whole thing. And then I got booked. It's really, dude, the story of my life is very difficult. Then I was in Portugal for a while, 'cause I got booked on a circus show out there. And this is like, so all of this happened, and I guess like me skipping through and doing all of this is like me being like, this is the world of like a working circus artist. If you're not like an ENC grad who like gets booked with Cirque du Soleil or gets like, or any, you know, that's not fair. Any person who like gets booked on a long running show, it's like patching together work. I worked, you know, I worked with the Flying Espanas. I did super, super traditional like back lever on a motorcycle that's like going up a tight wire work. I did like, what else have I done? I did like a gig in Lock, Switzerland, where I was standing on a sway pole and Sean White's like going underneath me. You know, like I don't know how I wound up in this situation.
We're talking about Sean White, like the snowboarder.
Yeah.
I was literally just showing Josh a video of Sean White because he's training to do the Olympics again.
And dude, work. Love that.
So wait, I want to hear a little bit more about this sway pole Sean White moment.
Oh, I mean, like he was just there. So there's a place called Lock Switzerland. It's very expensive. Martinis there are like $25. but I was living in a tiny little attic in Berlin, and a friend of mine was like, I can't take this gig. I'm simply too tired. It's only like And this is an idea of like what the circus, like, there's certain gigs in Europe, like the climate over there. She was like, it's only 2000 euro. I can't take it. I just can't go to Switzerland for the weekend. I was like, girl, I'll take it. What is it? She was like, all right, well, I'll send the director your stuff and whatever. And at first they didn't want to take me because they were like, you're too heavy. And I was like, oh, okay. And then they called me up and were like, no, you're fine. Come on. And so, yeah, they flew me.
They said that to your face?
Switzerland. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like that was the same.
Like you were too heavy for the
sway pole? I was too heavy for the sway pole.
Okay.
Which is not true.
No. No. And those things are built for a lot of weight. Okay.
But this is the industry. I mean, it sucks, but like, I don't know. This is like part of the
reality.
It's
also one of the interesting things about when you negotiate with foreign people, they don't necessarily have some of like the American or even North American like political correctness assumptions that, you know, I feel like, you know, one experience is here. Veronica Blair sort of talked about that a little bit on our episode with her, but going to Germany, being like, whoa, like German culture a little bit in experiencing it.
I mean, it's what I kind of love about the Germans. You always know where you stand with them. You know, it's just like, if something doesn't make sense, they'll say it. But yeah, so anyway. Oh, yeah. So that was just, you know, we would get up on a sway pole and all the like snowboarders and everybody who were competing would like come in under us and we would like go down and go back. And Shaun White was there. I don't know if I even saw him. He was just there.
That's amazing. So. This wasn't the same story. Person or director who told you that your headshot, you looked a lot prettier in person.
Yes. This was the guy who was like, oh yeah, you know, that's what he said when I was leaving. He was like, you know, you look a lot better in person than you do in your footage. And I was like, that makes zero. And then I realized it was because like everybody's stuff is like photoshopped, even though they tell you in school. And this is one of those things, like they tell you in school, never lie on your resume, never present a trick you can't do, you know. And some of that stuff is true, like, oh my god, like don't present a trick you can't do. But like, you want to get work, you have to, you know, like, I don't know. You have to be smart. That's all I'll say about that, I think.
As is the case probably with any kind of work, honestly.
I mean, you know, like that's it. It's like, I also lied on my restaurant resume when I was trying to get my first restaurant job. So, but it's that.
But it seems like, not to cut you off, but it's funny because, you know, in a way, actors are much more prepared for difficulty than I would say circus performers are. Like actors get told over and over again for many years, it's going to be hard. You're not going to get any work. Like nobody will like you. While circus performers just don't have that in the culture in the same kind of way, which I think makes for hardy people generally in acting.
Or very, 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 very fragile people.
No, those poor babies. I remember when I was doing that show. Oh man, the Greek drama that I was like the Deus Ex Machina for. And I remember watching one of the actors like going over his lines, and he was doing his emotional preparation work in the corner, and I was like doing my back bends to warm up, and I was like, I'm so glad I'm not you right now. This is awesome, you know? Like, what are you sweating about? What's the matter? I don't know. I also think that this. I mean, not to. Whatever. I also think in Vermont, there's very much this like, you can do what you want. You can like train whatever you want. Circus is for everybody, which is true. However, if you want to be a professional circus performer, you need to know the market and you need to know what you're up against and you need to know all of that.
Yes, the circus is for everybody topic is like one of my favorite questions because it's like a paradox. It's like, yes, circus is for everybody because anybody can enter it and find anything that fits them. But simultaneously, the point of circus is to be different from the rest of the world and do things that other people theoretically could not do. You know, so saying it's for it's has an interesting double meaning, that statement.
Well, it's for everybody. As long as you as a person are willing to like figure out what that thing is that you can do that not anybody else can do, you know, and you have the correct guidance and people who are willing to tell you or help you figure out those things and not necessarily say it's a shame we can't book you or you're too fat for the sway pole or whatever, you know. which I wasn't. And I wound up getting the gig and I made a bunch of money and stayed in Berlin a little while longer. So it was great.
And he has a nice martini in Switzerland.
Oh my God, $25 was
hopefully
ridiculous.
It was tasty.
I got one.
I want to compare some podcast notes. So tell me about your podcast journey.
Oh, yes. Oh, God. So the point of all of this was that piecing together a circus career, it's not for the faint of heart and it's not for the old. And I was getting to be around like 28, 29, 30. And I was like watching my friends who had gone different routes, like start to make like adult, like big girl money. And I was like, man, I'm still piecing together this like circus career. And like, when's it going to happen for me? And how's it going to happen for me? I don't know. And I don't know if it ever will. And so I met with a friend. Her name's Jennifer Crane, and she is known online as Cirque Physio. And I met her up with her in Atlanta. I had just come back from Germany or doing something. And she was like, you're such a good instructor and such a good speaker and such a good writer. You should just write one of your workshops as an ebook and like sell it online. And I was like, that's insane. People shouldn't do that. People, can you do that? Is that allowed? Can you teach online? You can't teach circus online, can you? Is that okay? Oh, well, okay. I need some money, so I'm going to do it. So I wrote this ebook and she was like, oh yeah. And you should also have a podcast. And I was like, that's insane. Nobody has a circus podcast except for Hideaway Circus. They're doing it right. But everyone else, they're already doing it. And then I decided to move back to Germany and I needed money. So I was like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to write this ebook and make this podcast and I'll see what happens. And the ebook did really, really well its first week. And I all of a sudden had more money in my bank account than I had made in like the last year. So I was like, all right, well, whatever this artist athlete stuff is, it's what I'm doing now. So let's go. And that's how I started a business and running a podcast.
Well, you do have a wonderful speaking voice. I can confirm that with your friend. It does help. I say the same thing with Lindsay. I don't have the acting training, so I feel like I'm always mumbling when I listen back to myself. But both of you have wonderful...
clearly did not go to the Atlantic Acting School.
Clearly not. Yes. David Mamet is rolling in his grave. He's not dead.
No, he's not. It's like he's not.
So, you know, I would say when we started our podcast, I really wanted to... like particularly in the very, very beginning, the first like 15 episodes, like interview people and get information out of them. I was like trying to understand for ourselves. So like a lot of questions, particularly in the first 10 episodes of like, how did you start your company? How did you do this? Like that are very focused on, you know, the interests in my life. But I'm wondering when you started it, did you have an idea of what you wanted to go for or a kind of guest or like, was there any, driving idea behind the way in which you were going to make it or who you were going to have on it or what you were going to talk about?
No, I think the biggest thing for me was I wanted to show that circus was diverse. That there, and by that I mean like there are a lot of different types of people who do it and that there are a lot of different pathways that can be taken in circus, that it's not necessarily just the performer that works for Cirque du Soleil and then they're done, you know, like that's not circus at all. That's not even what most of circus is. But I wasn't super intentional, you know, like I just kind of brought on people I knew and asked them questions about their lives. And as a result, the first like 10 episodes of my podcast are not that good. You know, they're probably like 30 minutes. And I probably ask people like, what do you eat for breakfast? You know, I didn't really know what I was doing at all.
Us neither, really. But okay, yeah. But you do feel, I definitely feel like we've both done now over 100 episodes. Congrats to you on hitting that mark
Congrats
as well.
To you guys.
I do feel like over time, like we've gotten way better at interviewing people. So I'm wondering, what do you think makes for a good interview and a good interview guest?
I think a good interview guest is someone who is not afraid to just talk. Just like go on and on and on. And it's funny because like, even now I'm like editing myself. I'm like, man, I'm really talking a lot. And I know a lot of my guests apologize. They're like, you're talking, like I'm talking a lot. And I'm like, yeah, that's why I brought you on. So you could just like talk and talk and talk. Like if I have to constantly be like drawing things out of you, God, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Yeah. You guys know it, but it's interesting because I don't always know what a good interview is. A lot of people will, and I'm getting a better gauge on it, but you know, like there are a couple of episodes where I was like, this is a great episode. When I had the dietitian on from ENC and she was like, she's a body positive dietitian who was like, this place is a fucking cesspool of eating disorders. I was like, wow, you said that on a microphone. Cool. Great. Let's run it. And because I knew that would do well. But for the most part, I don't know And it's always surprising to me, like, what interviews people really, really attach themselves to and are like, I listened to this and it changed my life. And then what interviews, like, I get really excited to put out. And then people are like, oh, that was fine. What? Who's next? You know?
Do you have any favorite, like, podcasts or radio voices or anybody who, like, you would say you draw from, like, inspiration-wise?
I draw from this woman, Paula Pant, who's also from Atlanta, and she is a personal finance podcaster, and I love her voice, and I love her podcast, and she was the first, like, woman, she was the first podcaster I was listening to, and I was like, I could probably do this. She's doing it. I'm just going to do what she does, but with circus, and it's going to be great. So Paula Pant, she runs in a podcast called Afford Anything, and I love it. Right now, I'm a huge RuPaul's Drag Race fan, so I've been listening to The Bald and Beautiful. Lindsay, can we be best friends? Yes. I feel like we should just, like, hang out.
Yeah. We can practice Meisner together.
In drag.
Oh, we can practice Meisner together.
In drag.
Yes. So I've been listening to a lot of Trixie Patch's Bald and Beautiful lately.
Okay.
They've been, I don't know. I love drag. I think it's a great art form. And
is Robin Slanina a judge?
No, that's Skin Wars. Oh, okay. That RuPaul is also a judge on, but it has nothing to do with drag.
So somebody who, after maybe listening to this, hopefully didn't know about your podcast and now is discovering it, is there an episode you would point to of, like, start with this one or, like, anything you're really proud of that you would point to as, like, some of your favorite ones?
Well, I'm super proud of episode 100. I interviewed Victor Forma, who is my straps coach and also just, like, a legendary straps coach and, or not straps, I'm sorry, swinging trapeze coach. He basically invented swinging trapeze as we know it now. And I'm proud of the interview for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm very proud to introduce him to, like, just to have his voice, like, captured on audio and to have that kind of as a thing that now, like, lives in the world because he's getting older and he's already named his successor. So I think I can say, like, he's getting older and who knows how much longer we'll have him and his information and his story. And I'm super proud of that episode also on a technical level because it took, you know, two translators, I have an audio editor and she spent God knows how many, like, at some point she sent me a message that was like, I've stopped billing you for this, but you should know this is taking me a long time. And I was like, thank you, Allison Castanguay, who is my editor. She's in Portland, Oregon. And she is like, she's going to listen to this too. Thank you, Allison. You're amazing. Episode 100. If you're going to start with the podcast, if you're just a random person, I would go with episode 100. If you're a juggler, I have Wes Peden. I've had Tom Wall, you know, like if you're an aerialist, I've had Tanya Burka. I've had a lot of aerialists on the podcast just because I know more. If you're a clown, I've had John Gilkey.
That was a great interview as well.
I loved it so much. That was so fun.
One thing that I thought was, like, really one thing you have done that I wish, not wish, hopefully in the next hundreds of episodes, we will hit a similar thing is, but you've had somebody also who was, like, Chinese, who works in Australia, who came from the Chinese system.
Mr. Liu.
Mr. Liu, which I thought was another great, it's kind of like, in a weird way, it pairs with Victor's in a strange way, because they're, like, people who escaped, like, communism in their state circus in their various countries and then became coaches. Yeah.
Serchma Bayamba also, who is a contortion coach, she was a Mongolian treasure and also escaped, like, because Mongolia was also formulated the same way. It was a communist state where the artists were owned by the state, and she went through state training and then came to the U.S. Yeah, it's crazy. I love that. I love that, too, because it's such a great examination of the way different cultures fund and treat circus. Which is something that I think in North America, we have a very specific idea of. And so it was important, like, and now I think about guests and bringing on guests from, Ethiopia. I want to have Zip Zap on at some point as well. So, like, just kind of getting an idea and showing people, like, yeah, circus is a thing everywhere, but the way it's treated, how it's funded, all of that is really different depending on where you are and what time period you're in too.
Laurence and Brent from Zip Zap were some of my favorite people we've interviewed, for sure. Recommend it. They each have an amazing individual stories, and the Zip Zap story is killer. So either listen to ours or interview them yourself. They're really great. Another question that I kind of wanted to pick apart for people who might be listening to us because they're interested in circus podcasts in particular is how a podcast is made. And I know we've taught you and I have talked about this, but could you talk a little bit about your like reveal the back behind the scenes process of how you make a podcast?
Okay. Well, I have a basement underneath my house that I paid a lot of money to have installed. It has a crocodile moat so that no one else can cross it. And I have to enter. I get a microphone and I plug it into my computer and I have a thing called Zencast.
A team of people. I would say the difference is like Lindsay and I don't basically like do it ourselves.
My team is Josh.
Have a Patreon, you have subscribers, you have people who are getting like backstage content. There's like kind of a different like way of doing it than I would say Lindsay and I do it.
Hmm. I started the way you guys started. It was just me and Brett Copes, who's a rigger and was going to be a podcaster, but then decided not to be, gave me a microphone. And actually from the beginning, I did have a sound editor. That's not true. I had a sound editor because I believed, first of all, that I didn't know anything about sound editing and didn't want to learn. And I hated listening to podcasts where the sound was bad. And I kind of thought about like, all right, when I'm on stage, I want to be well lit. When I'm on a microphone, I want to be well sounded. I want to
well
sound
heard.
Good.
Yeah.
Well heard. Thank you. Yes. So, I want to be well heard. And so I need a sound editor. So that was the first thing I kind of brought on, because it's funny, like the podcast, I think, is what I'm known a lot for. It has a really large reach. It's a really lovely The Artist Athlete podcast, which is available anywhere you like to listen. And
don't drop the Patreon while you're dropping.
That's right. Patreon.com/TheArtistAthlete, you know,
to support the pod.
Please do. I knew that it wasn't the only part of my business, and it's actually not the part of my business that makes me pretty any money at all. So I knew that I couldn't spend most of my time doing it, but I wanted a piece of content that I could produce weekly, and the podcast just seemed like the thing. I wasn't going to write a blog weekly. I wasn't going to do a newsletter weekly. I like talking to people. I was going to do the podcast. So I needed a good system from the get-go to like create content or create these episodes. So post-production came first. I would book all my guests, ask them a bunch of questions, and then edit it myself and then send it off. And after a while, that just became too much, especially after I moved to Montreal. I've written a couple of ebooks, growing my Instagram account, growing my following, training on my own, and still like booking and performing and doing all of that. You know, like it just got to be a lot. So when I came to Montreal, I met a woman who trains with Victor as well. And she's now my assistant who emails all my guests, and she's awesome too. She found Mr. Liu. She's from Melbourne, and is Australian. So she has a whole other connection to like Australian circus and all of that. And she knows the circus world, so she can reach out to people. So it's basically Hannah books all my guests, does everything, puts it in my GCal. I log on to my platform at the time. I ask them the questions. And then I send it to Allison to get edited, and it goes out.
Have you considered doing, and this is a leading question because I know you have, but like taking the podcast either to video or something like Clubhouse and like, you know, using some of the interview techniques?
What is Clubhouse?
Clubhouse is...
Is it only on iPhones? I don't have an iPhone.
Well, I think it's going to be on everything, but by the time it makes it to Android, I think the fad might be over. We'll see. It's feeling more and more like a fad and less like a thing that will click. But it's basically
more of a Snapchat and less of a TikTok.
Yes, and well put. It's more of a Snapchat. It's like
Snapchat
Zoom, basically,
like
with
around.
Like open rooms and audio only.
So it's blank. You just hear people's voices.
You just hear people, and you could have an open artist athlete, an open hideaway circus room. Anybody could come in, and I could be like, "Oh, Shannon, talk," and then I could unmute you as the moderator, and we could have kind of like a podcast but live.
Cool.
But. So it sounds like you're up to Clubhouse. Are you considering
doing
video?
I went off on another direction.
That's okay.
But video, yes. I wanted to do video for a while. And I actually just produced my first video episode. It's only available for Patreons, patreon.com/theartistathlete. It's with a friend of mine, Rachel Strickland, who runs the Audacity Project, which is kind of a project to help creatives. She informally calls it a project to help creatives get their shit together. And it's basically like, this is how you have a website. This is how you, you know, have an artist statement. This is how you get all of your things together to work as an artist. And she was also, she's from San Francisco. She's worked at the Irish Aerial Dance Festival. She's had a whole career. So I interviewed her and I knew her well. So I was like, can we try this video thing? Yeah, so I'll probably start putting out video on YouTube.
Exciting.
It's so easy.
It is so easy, and it makes, I was listening to, I know we have different podcast tastes, but I was listening to Joe Rogan talk about how when he went to Spotify, how not having YouTube, like, prevented it from being more viral. Like, YouTube basically makes podcasts.
Well, YouTube is the second most used search engine in the world, next to Google.
Well, they're both Google, I guess, really, right?
Yeah, right. But like, as far as like on a platform, you, like things that people search on, YouTube is second to Google, which just gives you an idea of the scope and scale of the platform. So it doesn't surprise me that, like, of course you can go viral on, I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
I do.
But video, yeah. Yeah, here for it.
I'm excited to see it. I do want to wrap up with the same three questions that all of our podcast guests get. I know you got them already once, but you'll get them again. Is there a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, other than the piece of advice you got at NECA that sounds terrible?
That was not like hardly advice.
Yeah, that was just like a statement, a rude statement
that has stuck with you.
That's what this whole interview has been. It's just been me being like, listen to all the shitty things people have said to me.
Honestly, I think it's helpful though, because on Instagram, it seems like people's lives are so easy and they get stuff. And then when you talk to them, you're like, oh, you had challenges just like me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, I think, really helpful for people to hear like the failures, really. Because we all can easily share our successes, but you learn the most from the failures and you like can understand where your failures are. Not so bad if you hear other people's failures too. And, you know, you don't feel so bad about yourself. So in that way, I think it was actually really helpful for you to just share all the not so great things people have said to you.
So anyway, so sorry, Josh.
So what's a good thing someone has said to you?
A good thing someone has said to me. What's a good thing someone has said to me? Why is this going to be so hard? Let's see. Okay, so on my podcast, Joel Baker, who's also a clown, has a really great kind of saying. He has three pieces of advice for circus artists, and I think it's so brilliant. Don't be lazy, save your money, and always be working on a good idea. Or the next idea, doesn't have to be good. Save your money, don't be lazy, always be working on a new idea. And I think that's fantastic advice for any human, actually, but circus artists. If you do those three things, you'll make it. You'll be fine.
Great advice. That's I'm with that. Second question. Yeah. Is there a book, a movie, a TV show, a live show, a podcast, anything about circus that you think is great that you would recommend somebody else check out?
Book. The Artist Athlete podcast is fantastic resource.
You are not allowed to count your own things.
Has anybody said my podcast?
Nobody says podcast. I don't think we've had anybody recommend any podcast.
I mean, yeah, that would be kind of rude. Okay, a circus related. Because I want to say, I mean, I know Gypsy Snyder has said this, but I want to say The Artist Way is like, if you want, like, again, like to foster creative talent. The Artist Way is really great, but I know she has said that, so I want to say something else. No, The Artist Way is great. I recommend The Artist Way to everybody.
Great.
Yeah.
No, it's good. I was just trying to think of if there was like, isn't Viewpoints and
Tina Landau. We kind of passed over Tina Landau, but she's got circus background talking about view. That's really a cutback to like 50 minutes ago almost. But
no work, yeah.
Yeah, the Viewpoints book is great.
That's kind of what I'm coming around to now. And to be honest, like some of the work I'm doing now with The Artist Athlete is a lot more, I'm doing a creative intensive lab right now, which is, I'm using a lot of less Viewpoints and more composition work to help people create acts. Because what I'm seeing a lot of in the direction that especially like aerial work is going in is like these like 1 minute like Instagrammable clips that then people put on stage and think is entertaining when it's not. So like what, like, because I feel like the art of creating an act is so different than the art of technical training. And so to help people with that, I'm kind of revisiting my Viewpoints composition, ETW self-scripting work in that format. So it's super fun. But the book by Tina Landau, yeah, It's all right. I think if you're going to look at any book from like those people, A Director Prepares by Anne Bogart is probably the one.
By the way, I took a whole semester of classes with Anne Bogart as the teacher interviewing other directors. And that was the inspiration for our podcast.
Oh, dope.
Was Anne Bogart's interviews in that class.
And then I was able to go to like one or two, because I had a different class at the same time. We chose different that semester. And I was like, I'm missing my class because she interviewed Julie Taymor. And I was like, cool. I want to hear her speak so badly. And I think I also went to the Diane Paulus one because, again, I wanted to hear
her. Her class was just an hour. It was a live podcast, hour to 2 hours, only for like the 40, 50 people in the room once a week. And that's like what she teaches at Columbia. And it's pretty.
So she just interviews directors?
She does stuff with the actors, but she has a class called Visiting Directors, which is like what she's, I think, pretty well known for. Like a lot of people sign up
I think it's the only one of her classes that you can take if you're not an acting
or a directing person.
Okay. Yeah. Acting or directing. So we were able to go to that because we did, you know, producing management.
But final question. Cool.
Yes, final question.
Before you get do a whole other round of this tomorrow morning.
Right.
Okay, last question. Who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Who did I say last time?
I don't remember.
I had
a screaming baby in my ear, so I don't know if I heard it.
Oh, I know who I said. I said it was kind of a competition, though. I want one, like me or you two, to have Franco Dragone and Guy Laliberté in conversation with each other.
Right.
Well, I can probably get you someone's contact to contact Franco. I've tried.
I got a contact for Franco, but he hasn't written back yet. Apparently, he's better.
I got all the way through to Guy's assistant and got shot down. But many people I do like, I try again multiple years later, and then they say yes once like time has passed. So no, like I think year two of doing the podcast, year three, when he was doing the triangle, I messaged his personal assistant. He doesn't have time. He's in Miami. I was like, okay, great. I'll try again later. So we'll see. Maybe in a few years.
Did that triangle ever go anywhere?
The
show.
What triangle?
He made a pyramid that was like a whole show, but no performers.
In Miami.
It was in Montreal projection. In the Old Port, and then it went to Miami. And it was just lights and sound and no performers. But the experience was you like show up and it's like a crazy visual music experience.
You're like in a reclined beach chair or something. We have friends who did it.
Cool.
I don't think it went super well. In any case.
Sounds like a time.
I hope either of us nail those interviews. They would be fascinating. Shannon, thank you so much for doing our podcast. Like, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I'm really glad we redid it because this is exactly what I was hoping for originally. So
I'm so
this
glad.
Is, I'm excited I'm for folks to hear this. And that was our interview with Shannon McKenna.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And go get your tickets to Beyond Babel, reopening in New York City September 28th. You can get your tickets at beyondbabelshow.com.
Have a good weekend. Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.